Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Cuban Sandwich, A History in Layers, by Andrew T. Hughes, Barbara C. Cruz, and Jeff Hauck. Narrated by Gary Tiedemann. Introduction. Hungry patrons line the long curve of the horseshoe-shaped counter. Standing tall on a small platform behind it, the aproned lonchero, or sandwich man, wields his large knife. In quick and efficient movements, he cuts several thin slices from a ham. Using the flat of the blade and a flick of his wrist, he flips the ham slices into a split loaf of long, crusty Cuban bread. He repeats the process with a large roast of pork that has been steeped with the savory flavors of Cuba, known as mojo, sour orange, garlic, cumin, and more. He then adds a slice or two of Swiss cheese, pickled cucumber, and paints the top face of the sandwich with mustard. Finally, the lonchero butters the very top of the sandwich and clamps it into a hot press. With pressure and heat, the flattened, layered creation emerges a Cuban sandwich, burnished into a distinctive, toasty melt. When prepared well, the Cuban sandwich enthralls with the first bite, the audible crunch as your teeth shatter the toasted Cuban bread and plunge into the warm fillings inside. Sweet ham, pungent Cuban roast pork, the subtle charm of Swiss cheese, briny pickles, mustard, and sometimes more are sliced and layered to become one dynamic flavor on the palate. Depending on when and where one orders a Cuban sandwich, the eatery may have added other ingredients. While aficionados debate whether salami belongs on a true Cuban, fewer understand just how mixed up the ingredients in old mixto sandwiches can be. Then, there's all the strange things Americanos and others have put on their Cubans. Miami, Key West, and Tampa have wrangled over the claim to be the Cuban sandwich's true hometown for years. Countless restaurants, bars, and lunch trucks have adopted the sandwich for their menus, along with corporate giants such as McDonald's, Arby's, and Pollo Tropical. In Hollywood, the film Chef, 2014, vaulted the sandwich into the international limelight. Active interest in the Cuban sandwich online increased 12-fold, 1,200%, between 2004 and 2018. There are restaurants dedicated to making the sandwich as a specialty across the globe, while Cuban-inspired recipes proliferate online. The Cuban sandwich, conceived by the Cuban people and adopted by the United States, truly belongs to the world now. All the world, it would seem, except for Cuba itself. The Cuban sandwich seems so simple with store-bought shortcuts, but is in fact a series of labor-intensive recipes assembled into a new whole. Anyone making one for an experienced audience must often contend with idiosyncratic expectations for absurdly low prices. Armchair artisans relish in quibbling over their preferences for ingredients, the rights and rights of pressing, condiments, and so on. Sandwich slingers around the world have crafted their own versions in a search for perfection, or at least a living. Ask 100 locals in Miami or Tampa, and you will get 100 stories, told with passionate certainty that their grandfather or local cafe taught them the proper way, the only way to prepare and eat the sandwich. Journalists and food writers have pondered the story of the Cuban sandwich for decades. Clearly, an examination of the historical record and the sandwich's cultural impact is necessary. Now, at long last, there is a chronicle worthy of this outsized sandwich and the people who create it, brought to you by three of the sandwich's most obsessive fans. Dr. Barbara Cruz is a Cuban-American educator, and like most Cubans, She has a serious fixation on food. Jeff Hauck is a restaurant marketer with a voracious eye for detail and an insider's perspective of the hospitality business. Andrew Hughes is an archivist, historian, and sandwich obsessive who has had a long-time fascination with the Cuban sandwich and its historic roots. Together, we trace the epic journey of the mixto, cubano, and medianoche from hazy origins through the cafes of Havana and on to several generations of exiles in new lands. We explore how the crusty creation became a beloved symbol for a displaced people, won the hearts and mouths of America, and claimed a place on the world stage. Through historic research using sources from Cuba and the United States, we place the sandwich in the context of the Cuban-American exile experience and the marketplace of popular culture. We bring the story of the sandwich to life with interviews and profiles of artisans who practice the arts of Cuban bread, ham, roast pork, and more. Finally, listeners will find professional tips for creating their own glorious Cuban sandwiches at home, and in the process, honor the journeys of those who made it possible. Before we get to sandwiches, it would be helpful to briefly review the word itself and its cultural implications. While the Spanish-speaking world generally uses sandwich to denote a meal constructed between slices of bread, it also uses other words, such as bocadillo, small bite, a term that could refer to a wide range of appetizers. Another common Spanish word for sandwich is emparedado, which means to be walled in or surrounded. The use of emparedado was especially championed by people living in Santiago, Cuba, as an alternative to the invasive Yankee word, which Cubans found difficult to pronounce. English speakers make a hard D sound by touching their tongues to the ridge between the upper teeth and the hard palate. Spanish speakers make a softer sound by touching their tongues to the back of their upper teeth. To emulate the hard D, many Cubans substituted a G sound, resulting in sandwich. There is some significance to the usage of emparedado, not only for being the Spanish word adopted for the sandwich, but for its other meaning. Cubans throughout history could deeply identify with an essence being trapped between unyielding pressures. Being a colony in a far-flung empire meant that Cubans spent centuries steeped in the tension between loyalty and independence. Colonists born in Cuba may have been Spanish by lineage, but by virtue of being born in the colonies, they were ranked as a lower class, criollo, creole, than those born in mainland Spain, known as peninsulares. Creoles in search of status would always be caught between the expectations of nobility and the reality of their Cuban birth. The children of mixed-race couples, Afro-Cubans, known then as mulatos, were even more socially disadvantaged. After independence, the unequal and seemingly doomed romance between Cuba and the United States ended during the pressures of the Cold War. Cuba became a pawn of the Soviet Union and the target of an unyielding U.S. trade embargo. Cuban exiles who resettled in the United States may have found safety and prosperity, but were condemned to a life suspended between two worlds. Cubans of all shades and persuasions have known what it feels like to have one's fate determined by people in distant lands, to be trapped or walled in by overwhelming forces, from the sugar market to the Cold War. A Cuban sandwich is made complete, after all, when it is crushed between two hot sheets of metal, hardening its shell until its insides melt and its fat begins to render. In most of the material written about the sandwich, it is typically represented with a couple of sentences and a short list of store-bought ingredients to assemble. This radically reductive approach strips the sandwich of context, including the people and culture who created it in the first place. Hiding between the thin slices of its fillings are invisible layers of meaning, the spirit of a people, and the story of a nation. The Life and Times of the Cuban Sandwich. A note on research. This book represents an earnest attempt to tell the story of the Cuban sandwich with the limited resources available. Politics and pandemics have complicated research in Cuba itself, and relevant written Cuban sources are scarce in the United States. We encourage others to build upon our efforts when more information becomes readily available. Chapter 1. The Pearl. The Pearl of the Antilles. Much like Cuban bread holds the fillings of the sandwich together, history binds this epic story. The creation of what we know as a Cuban sandwich appears to have roughly coincided with the birth of an independent Cuban republic. In 1492, Christopher Columbus blundered across the Antilles Islands and the New World while looking for Asia. The Spanish Empire conquered Cuba in 1512, using it as a launching pad for the subjugation of much of Central and South America. The cultivation of sugar and tobacco, fueled with African slave labor, made Cuba a vital strategic and economic asset, the coveted Pearl of the Antilles. Governed by bureaucrats an ocean away in Spain, Cubans learned to ignore most imperial decrees and to distrust law and authority. In the 1700s, as much as 3/4 of the tobacco harvest was smuggled out of the country, rather than sold to Spanish authorities at fixed prices. Beginning in the 1760s, slave-cultivated sugar became Cuba's chief export crop. This new direction for the colony promised riches, but also tied the fate of the island to an inherently unstable market and an immoral, unsustainable labor system. Much of Cuba's natural, capital, and human resources were devoted to the volatile fortunes of the sugar industry, leaving little for subsistence. As a result, Cuba still struggled with the issue more than 200 years later, with much of its economic life determined by the international demand for sugar. While the population shot up during the 1800s, the volume of livestock and food crops declined. By the 1890s, Cuba's dependence on imported food sharply increased, along with prices. Life could be difficult on the island, but Cuba was among the Spanish Empire's richest prizes. The dynamics of race were more fluid in Latin America than in the English-speaking colonial world. In the colonial days, many Afro-Cubans earned their freedom, or were born free, and Spanish law recognized their rights. Free blacks dominated several artisan trade guilds and joined local militias. Many Spaniards and criollos, Spaniards born in the colonies, had relationships with Afro-Cuban women, many of these unequal by nature, ranging from rape and concubinage to genuine marriage. The dearth of whites left plenty of space for blacks to participate in public life. All these factors gave rise to a culture that, while not colorblind, was less sharply segregated than many others at the time. Havana became Cuba's biggest window to the rest of the world and a powerful cultural incubator. The port city produced hard wooden pegs called clavijas, used for shipbuilding, an industry with deep roots in Havana. The people soon turned the pegs into a signature percussion instrument, the clave, which is used to create the bedrock rhythm inherent in much of Cuban dance music. Havana took on a more cosmopolitan character in the 1800s, with more hotels, cafes, and its first steamship route in 1821, establishing a connection with New Orleans. Nightlife was decidedly raucous, with the exception of the nicer theaters and the Filarmónica. Cuba's political culture reached a fever pitch in the mid-1800s. A new, strident nationalism was reflected in the rise of lectores, the readers hired to recite news and literature to the workers in cigar factories. Initially, lectores were typically affiliated with the newspaper printed by labor unions based in Havana. Later, Workers in a given factory hired their own lectores and chose the material to be read. The voices of political and labor ferment gave rise to a new consciousness, the dream of a nation yet to be born. Cuban cuisine. The renowned Cuban anthropologist Fernando Ortiz compared his nation's identity to the cooking of ajiaco, a stew of Spanish beef, native Indian ají, chili peppers, and starchy tubers such as yuca and yams that were associated with African slave food. Taíno natives prepared ajiaco originally in a hole in the ground, lined with leaves, probably banana. The ingredients cooked slowly, simmered by the sun. Over time, members of the tribe might take some to eat and add more ingredients to the stew. In this way, ajiaco might cook for many days or even weeks at a time. The strong flavor of the chilies had the virtue of masking the flavors of spoiled ingredients. Some Cubans interpret their culture as an ongoing ajiaco, which is never fully cooked or quite complete. To fully understand Cuban cuisine, it is best to know something beyond ingredients and demographics to contemplate the spirit of the people. In his Global Handbook devoted to Cuba, Ted Henkin writes, "Cuban etiquette revolved around the national characteristics of boisterousness and loquaciousness, sensuality and secularity, jocularity and mockery, ambition and modernity." The most distinctive social characteristic shared by Cubans is a deep sense of hospitality. Cubans also tend to hold conversations at an unusually high volume and are masters at the art of conversation, often holding forth for hours. Antonio Benítez Rojo, one of Cuba's literary greats, identified the two conflicting natures in the island's history, known as Cuba Grande and Cuba Pequeña. Big and little Cuba, respectively. Authoritarianism, pride, brutality, and sugar plantations represented the big Cuba of the financial elites, but did not represent the soul of the common people, or little Cuba. The true Cuban spirit, also known as lo cubano, or the Cuban way, could only be found in little Cuba. The most famous and durable creations of Cuban culture would not be passed down by elites, but percolated insistently from below. Even Cuba's food was traditionally produced on small-scale sitio farms, often run by ex-slaves and their descendants who were fiercely proud of their humble estates. Some scholars have traced the origins of an independent Cuba to the rich body of literature produced there beginning in the mid-1800s. Among a flowering of revolutionary thought, the upstart nation's earliest cookbooks were vital in forging an identity apart from Spain's. Comida criolla, Creole food, became an important facet of Cuban nationalism in the 1850s. Advocates of independence renounced Spain and its system of sugar and slaves, while extolling Cuban folk traditions, especially food. Cuban cookbooks arose along with the island's literacy rate and growing middle class, documenting the depth and local variety of the national cuisine at the time. Cuban nationalists held up ingredients such as boniato, also known as white sweet potato, plantains, and yuca, and recipes such as ajiaco as being distinctly Cuban rather than Spanish. True criolla cuisine included indigenous and African influences. If the primordial bedrocks of Cuban food can be found in ajiaco, other vital ingredients made a more dynamic cuisine possible. Influences from Spain were strongly felt on the Cuban table. Previously a luxurious import, rice became such a staple in Cuba that it is difficult to imagine the island's food without it. Chinese railroad laborers helped to popularize rice cultivation in the mid-1800s. Cubans embraced it with the passion of the newly converted, and it was soon served with virtually every meal, including dishes that already boasted plenty of starch. The crop also made Spanish-style arroz con pollo, chicken with yellow rice, attainable for more Cubans, who adopted it as a favorite, as it was across most of Latin America and the Spanish-speaking Caribbean. Congrí is a criolla rice favorite, mixing red beans with rice, a simple dish with countless variations. Mixed black beans and rice are popularly known as moros y cristianos, Moors and Christians, referring to the mixing of black and white ingredients. Cubans often prefer meat over seafood, especially beef, pork, and more recently chicken. Iconic dishes include ropa vieja, old clothes, a braised shredded beef dish, and picadillo, a dish of ground beef simmered with tomato and more, invariably accompanied by black beans, white rice, plantains, and tubers such as yuca. Pork had been a staple in Cuba since the days of Columbus's second transatlantic voyage in 1493, when the conquistador introduced pigs to the New World. Rough and hardy, the Spanish pigs had no natural enemies on the island and multiplied freely. They quickly became the protein of choice for the slow-cooked barbacoa of the local Taíno Indians. From hogs, Cubans cured ham and prepared lechon, slow-roasted pork that may or may not be made from suckling pig, hence the reference to milk, leche, in its name. Cuban lechon is usually marinated in a sour orange, lime, garlic, and oregano sauce, called mojo. It seems only natural that ham and lechon would later be used as the basis for a sandwich that bears the island's name. It is important to note that none of the scholars discussing traditional Cuban food include any sandwiches, let alone the mixto or Cuban sandwich, in their discussions. Cuba Libre. Spain had lost most of its vast empire in the early 1800s, but Cuba and Puerto Rico remained colonies of the crown. Cuba's continuing fealty to Spain won approval as the ever-faithful isle from Madrid, but there was a limit to the people's loyalty. Imperial bankruptcy prompted crushing taxes and trade regulations, and Cubans soon demanded more representation and autonomy. Periodic slave revolts and bloody repression further destabilized the colony. Spanish authorities routinely imprisoned or exiled political dissidents and advocates of independence. Known as El Exilio, the exile, the Cuban diaspora began as early as 1823. That is when Spanish authorities sentenced Cuban religious leader, humanitarian, and political advocate Father Félix Varela y Morales to death for being too critical of Madrid. Varela y Morales fled Cuba for a life of exile and distinguished charity work in New York City. The first significant numbers of Cuban immigrants came to the United States in 1832, with many settling in Key West. Vexed by the simmering issues of independence and slavery, much of Cuba revolted against Spanish rule during the inconclusive 10 Years' War, 1868 to 1878. Starting in 1868, a steady stream of exiles fled the violence and hardship to Key West, which quickly transformed the small island into Florida's biggest city and the capital of cigar production in the United States. Although the struggle failed to achieve independence, the rebellion left a legacy of Cuban exile communities across the Western Hemisphere. In 1879, just after the war's end, an estimated 50,000 Cubans lived in the United States, with about 2,400 in Key West. To Spain's chagrin, Cuba's economy and exiles gradually reoriented itself toward the growing wealth of the United States. Collectively and individually, the exile community was mobile, resilient, and rather prosperous. It was composed of intellectuals, skilled workers, and laborers alike. Because the rebellion lasted for so long, many Cubans became accustomed to the idea of indefinite exile, but they were determined to have a voice in the future of their budding island nation. El exilio became a respected rite of patriotism understood by all politically active Cubans. The independence movement rapidly regrouped from an isolated peasant and slave rebellion into a revolution that tapped into people's hopes for a more equitable Cuba. The ideals of the exile community were best expressed by José Martí, the foremost intellectual leader of the Cuban independence movement. Beginning in 1895, Cuban rebels outfought and outran the Spanish during the Cuban War for Independence, but the struggle took a terrible toll on the people and economy. The United States went to war with Spain in April 1898, about 2 months after the USS Maine exploded in Havana Harbor, although economic and geopolitical concerns had already made a conflict likely. Unwilling to allow another expansionist country to control the island should Spain withdraw, U.S. strategists also resisted the idea of an independent Cuba. By calling it the Spanish-American War, 1898, diplomats and historians at the time managed to exclude the pretext for the war in the first place, the struggles of Cubans and Filipinos for independence from empires. The Spanish-American War lasted from April until August, and U.S. troops invaded, ostensibly to aid the Cuban rebels. After fighting over Cuba, Puerto Rico, and the Philippines, the United States seized most of the remnants of Spain's overseas empire. The sometimes disorderly behavior of U.S. troops can be better understood by the potent cocktail that was popularized during the war. The Cuba Libre, Free Cuba, made with Cuban rum, American Coca-Cola, and lime, had three active ingredients: alcohol, caffeine, and cocaine. After a few of those, drinkers might feel that they could conquer the whole world, not just the Isle of Cuba. Cocaine was phased out of the Coca-Cola recipe in 1903. Even if Coca-Cola wasn't readily available to soldiers in the field, many of them never left the mainland and spent much of their free time seeking out beverages. While Cuba was not formally made a U.S. territory, such as Puerto Rico, Guam, and the Philippines, it did not attain complete independence either. The peace settlement ensured that Cuba would become a dependency of the United States, and therefore did little to mollify advocates of true Cuban independence. Enter the Yankee. "Cuba is simply overrun with Americans of all ages," the New York Times observed, "of all conditions of life, of all professions, and of no professions. Years ago, the rush was to the west of the United States. Now, the tide has turned southward to Cuba." In 1899, an ice cream parlor in Havana printed newspaper ads specifically aimed at ladies in English. While some visitors from the North took interest in Cuban food, they usually viewed anything unfamiliar with suspicion. One American housewife living in Cuba observed in 1905, "Cuban cooking is greasy and mysterious. It is unsuited for delicate digestion and is not always appetizing in appearance, although many of the dishes are excellent, and one soon learns what to avoid. The Cuban cook can prepare rice as no American domestic worker can ever hope to. It comes to the table a fluffy mass, white and dry, with each grain distinct, and with a flavor that makes it popular from the first tasting in the transplanted family." Cuba's hospitality industry expanded to accommodate the steady stream of Americano investors, tourists, and new residents. In 1899 and 1900, well-financed entrepreneurs from the United States had a keen advantage in opening hotels and other businesses with names like the American Tea Room, the Manhattan Bar, the Gay Broadway Cafe, the New England Bar, the Greater New York Cafe, the American Soda Shop, and so on. Yankee businessmen brought more than their money and language with them. The new proprietors of the Café Washington from El Norte refused to serve dark-skinned Cubans. When authorities closed the cafe, the owners unsuccessfully appealed the case to the Cuban Supreme Court, which rebuked the idea of racial segregation. A new, vibrant Cuba was emerging from out of the shadows of Spanish rule. The people longed for modernity and independence, for baseball instead of bullfights.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?